People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Fine Music Radio and Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to Jan Hugo, a South African pianist who's currently living in France. He was born in South Africa, started his musical education in Pretoria, and then when he was only 11, he discovered his passion for piano music and was determined to become a concert pianist. He soon received an opportunity to play Saint-Saëns' fifth piano concerto with an orchestra and then to tour South Africa. And when he was just 13 years old, he was invited by Francesco Cioppoletta to continue his studies in Modena in Italy, where he completed his Bachelor of Music degree with honorary mention cum laude. Then he won various competitions, including in South Africa, first prize at the UNISA National Piano Competition in Pretoria, overall winner of the SAMRO Bursary Competition, first prize of the Royal Overseas League Piano Competition in London, and second prize at the Alcan Zimmermann Competition in Athens. He left Italy and moved to Leipzig in 2013 and now lives in France with his wife. So you've been in. Welcome, first of all, Jan. Welcome to People of Note.
Thank you very much.
I'm glad I caught up with you right at the end of your tour, because I've caught you just before you're going back. And it has been a tour, hasn't it? It's just not a visit.
Yes, it's been a tour. I think my wife and I gave more or less 10 concerts.
Is your wife also a musician?
She's a singer.
Oh, that's very useful.
Yes.
Where did you go? Was it a countrywide tour?
Yes, we played in Johannesburg and in Pretoria. And then I gave a recital at the Piano Symposium in Stellenbosch. And then we were in Grahamstown, Bloemfontein, and we gave various concerts here in Cape Town and around Cape Town.
Yes, and I was put in touch with you by Herbert Gluckner, because you also gave a recital for the Richard Wagner Society.
Yes, I did.
So it's good to be able to hear you here. Do you come back fairly often to Cape Town?
Yes, I do. I come back more or less once a year.
Okay.
But actually, I'd love to come back more often. I really feel like after 14 years in Europe, more than half of my life, actually.
Yes, I was going to say 14 years is a long time, because you're still a very young man, aren't you?
I am, yes. I'm 27.
Okay. You're allowed to give your age away.
Yeah, I feel like I need to reconnect with my roots here in South Africa, and having lived in different cultures in Europe, you know, it's enriching, but it can be confusing as well.
Indeed.
You know? Yes.
And what about languages? You lived in Italy for a while, so what did you do language-wise? Have you managed to learn to speak Italian and German and now French?
Yes. So I speak five languages.
Oh, do you?
Yes, I do. Italian was, I would say it was my third mother language, actually, because I grew up Afrikaans and English, like many people here in South Africa. And then, well, I learned Italian when I was 12, and then at 13 I left. And I lived there, and so I really spoke Italian like an Italian.
People
did not realize that I came from South Africa.
Oh, well done.
And then I went to Germany, and then I learned German, but then I actually learned French in Germany, because I was exposed to there was a whole French community in Leipzig. And so now the French has sort of replaced the Italian. I can still speak Italian, but I get mixed up with French.
No wonder you're confused and want to come back home. And how did you meet your wife? Is she French, did you say?
She's French, yes. And we met in Leipzig, actually, at the Hochschule. We were both studying there. And we were supposed to actually do a tandem when we help one another learn new language. And she was supposed to help me learn German, and I helped her with her Italian. And I learned French somehow.
Well done. And now, what, for example, it's difficult asking a concert pianist what he does during the day, but I actually do mean that. What are you involved with at the moment in France?
Well, a big part of my work is accompanying my wife, and we give recitals together a lot, which I really enjoy, and I love opera and singing as well, so it's a real pleasure for me. It's really also influenced my solo playing. I feel like it's much richer now with the exposure to opera and singing, and you just see things from a different perspective, actually.
Yes.
And I'm busy preparing for, I'm giving a recital at the beginning of June on four different historical instruments, and a new modern piano that is inspired by historical instruments. So, I'm working on a lot of projects, and I'm organizing a masterclass in the summer in France.
Gosh, so you really are kept busy.
Yes.
And especially, but you get to play recitals as well, not just accompanying your
wife.
Yes,
yes, I do. Yes,
a fair amount of recitals and masterclasses, as you said.
Yes, yes.
One of the things I discovered about you is that you've done much research into the 19th century style of playing. But I want to talk about that in a short while, because I'd like to hear about that in some detail. Yes. Also about one of the pianos that you played, a straight-strung concert grand, which we'll come to. But I'm intrigued, first of all, to hear what your first piece of music is and why you've chosen it.
Yes, so my first piece of music is actually a recording of Bartok playing Liszt Sursum Corda. This is actually part of the whole research that I did into 19th century playing, and I find it fascinating to listen to Bartok as a pianist playing Liszt, who was also Hungarian, and Bartok was a student of Liszt, actually. So there's sort of a direct line of transmission, we could say. And we're so used to hearing Bartok's music played in a very percussive way, but actually, when you listen to his own playing, it was extremely sentimental. And it's curious because there was a student of Bartok playing a piece of his to Bartok, and Bartok said, "Oh, please don't play that so Bartokish."
Bartok said that to the student. Yes. That is interesting. So we must listen. Tell us, just guide us what to listen for. Just Liszt not being percussive.
Yes, and Liszt being played by someone who knew a student of Liszt, and we can really feel how much emotion went into their playing. It's fascinating, and it's not perfect playing. It's very personal and individual, and that's what I love about it.
Thank you.
That was Béla Bartók himself playing music by Liszt, Sursum Corda, is that right?
Yes, yes.
The first choice of my guest on People of Note here on Fine Music Radio this week, the pianist Jan Hugo, who's based in France with his wife at the moment, as you've heard. And I saw here, and also you've just mentioned Liszt rather enthusiastically, that you are passionate about Franz Liszt music and his influence on piano playing and piano technique. Does that come from way back in your life, or is it a recent development?
Yeah, it comes from way back, actually. When I was 12, my father brought me home from England a set of CDs of Liszt music played by Georges Bollet, or Bollet, I think.
Yes.
And I remember I drove my parents mad because I only listened to Il Penseroso and the Dante Sonata every day at breakfast.
Not breakfast music.
No, not really. And I've always had a very special connection with this composer, especially the more introspective works. And then for a while, it sort of slipped out of my life, and it came back a few years, two years ago, more or less. And I participated in the Liszt competition in Utrecht, where I was a semi-finalist. And actually, I had an accident. I fell from my bicycle and I hurt my right wrist. And so for a while, I couldn't play piano with my right hand. And I started thinking about piano technique, and I discovered these historical recordings that were made at the end of the 19th century, especially of the students of Liszt. So we have Frédéric Lamond and Arthur Friedheim, who was Liszt's secretary, and we can hear them play. And my wife's father actually is a physiotherapist who specializes in musicians' dystonia. So he helps a lot of musicians that have technical problems, and he talked to me about Marie Jaël, who was a student of Liszt and a friend of Liszt, and she wrote 7 books on piano technique, on the art of touch. And I started getting into this gradually and reading, and I discovered that, you know, piano technique is a very deep subject as well, and there's been a lot of thought going into it, even in the 19th century. They really thought about it and explored what we could do with our hands and how it influenced music, etc. So that started like a process of thought in my head, and I started reading about Liszt's masterclasses and what he told his students, and thinking of how his writing reflected the way he used his hands. And then I had the honor of working with a few people who actually specialized in Liszt, and especially Bertrand Ott, who wrote a book called Liszt's Pedagogical Approach to Piano Playing. So, yes, it's been a voyage, actually, with Liszt, and so performing in the Liszt competition was just sort of an occasion to play a huge amount of Liszt repertoire of unknown works as well, even chamber music with violin and piano, which is very rare, yes. And together with that goes the instrument the interest for historical instruments, actually.
Okay. Let's come back to the instruments in a moment. I just want to talk a bit more about Liszt and ask you some questions.
Yes.
You've already said how you are interested in his more private sort of works, because one does think of Liszt as the showman, doesn't one?
Yes.
He was allegedly the man who invented a piano recital, turning the piano on its side, wearing gloves, being very much a showman on the stage. Mm. And a lot of his music is very showy. And so then would you agree that a lot of pianists play up the showy side, maybe at the expense of technique, proper technique, and also the music?
I totally agree. I think Liszt is he was a typical man of the 19th century, and having lived from 1811 to 1886, he saw during his life, things evolved enormously.
Massively, yes.
So when Liszt was young, it's interesting that like a solo piano recital did not exist. To play a Beethoven sonata in public was unheard of when he was young. It was only concerts with opera fantasies and potpourris of all different things and supporting artists. And it's funny, actually. There's a concert program that Chopin organized when he was young, and it was the first movement of his piano concerto, and then a singer, and then a quartet, and then this and that, and then the second and third movements.
Oh,
so, you know, it's very different from what we do today.
We've become very formal, haven't we?
We have.
I think for the better, for a lot of, but it also can be a bit intimidating.
Yes, I think it's a balance between appreciating also the more serious music that has been written, and also making it an occasion where it's fun as well. Mm-hmm. So to come back to Liszt, I mean, he was a paradoxical man. I recently read a book about him and his religious fervor, actually. And it's interesting that when he was 16, he went through a terrible depression, and he felt that he wanted to become a priest. And he went to the priest of the church that he went to and said, he wanted to take orders. And I think Liszt's mother actually convinced the priest to tell him to not do it and to rather serve God with his musical gift.
Yes.
And Liszt was actually bitter for the whole of his life about this. He felt that he had been sort of cut off from what his real calling was. I think if you see Liszt's life and you know the fact that he was also a Don Juan, and I think there was something that he was looking for, you know, that he somehow felt that he had lost somewhere along the way. And I really feel that in his music there's something extremely profound, and there's a lot of religious fervor in his music. And yes, I mean, he was a fantastic pianist and huge technical capabilities. But what's interesting as well is that when you read the accounts of how he played later on in his life, especially, everyone agrees on the fact that he was the most amazing musician. Like, the music just oozed out of him, and nobody could make a piano groan and sigh and cry like Liszt could. You know, he did create the piano recital.
He did. The idea
that he once said, "Le concert, c'est moi. I am the concert." So, but if you see that in the context of the time when a pianist playing on its own did not exist.
And he needed to attract the audience.
He did.
And he needed to attract the ladies.
As yes.
He said, he was a bit of a Don Juan.
Yes, yes.
But did he not take minor orders, and for the rest of his life he walked around in a black cassock?
He did, yes.
To try, I suppose, to assuage his kind of disappointment,
I think so,
at not taking full orders.
Yes. It was definitely something that was really important to him. At the time, even people mocked him for that. They said it was just sort of part of a show. I mean, he was very much criticized even in his time. But there's an interesting anecdote, actually. Liszt was very well known. He was probably the most well-known man, besides from being a pianist, but in Europe. I mean, he visited the Pope and all the kings and the sultans, etc. And he actually went to a convent close to Rome to just for a spiritual retreat, and he wanted to be alone. And then the Pope heard about him being there, and the Pope said, no, you must come and play. And Liszt said, no, I'm not coming, I'm here in a spiritual retreat. And then the next morning, actually, the Pope himself came to the convent to convince Liszt to come and play. So I really think his relationship to fame, and it was not easy. I think he enjoyed it, but, you know, it's complicated.
Jan, let's have another music break. What's your next piece of music?
So my next piece of music is a recording of a Liszt student playing Liszt's Liebestraum. So Frédéric Lamond. Frédéric Lamond met Liszt when he was in his early 20s, and it was in the beginning 1880s. And there's an account of Lamond telling about how he met Liszt. And I find it fantastic, this recording, because we can have a glimpse into what Liszt's playing was like.
In one of his most famous pieces as
yes,
well.
Yes, and it's very touching because it's quite different from how we play it today. And it's extremely, it's so filled with emotion. It's amazing.
the famous Liebestraum by Liszt, and we've just heard it played by a pupil of Liszt, Friedrich Lamond. And as you said, Jan, it's quite different from the way we hear Liebestraum today on modern Steinways, isn't it?
Yes. Well, the instruments have evolved a lot
so
as well.
Much, yes.
Actually, on the tour, I gave a concert on a Blüthner of 1913, which was sort of an impromptu concert that was organized. And it's fascinating to play on an instrument that is more than 100 years old. I mean, in 1913, the instruments were more or less similar to what they are today. But going back even to 1860 or 1870, there's something different about the color of the sound and the way the piano speaks.
But then what do you think, and incidentally, Jan Hugo, a concert pianist, is my guest on People of Note this week. Jan, what do you think then of this, you know, the period instrument thing with the forte piano, taking us right back to the early 1800s with those very sort of clattery sound, for want of a better word?
Yes.
Do you go that far back in your research, or are you more in the 19th century?
I'm more interested, actually, in the 19th century.
The mid to later 19th century.
Yes, and especially what was happening in Paris.
Yeah. What about Chopin, dare I ask?
Yes.
After your passion for Liszt, where does Chopin fit in?
Well, Chopin is actually the next composer that I'm dedicating a lot of time and interest to. There's actually this year a Chopin competition on period instruments, which will be held for the first time in Warsaw.
Good grief.
So maybe, hopefully I'll be there. Chopin is interesting because the instruments that he played on did not resemble at all what a modern piano sounds like. I mean, Chopin died in 1849, I believe, and the big evolutions in the piano that made it closer to the modern one were towards the 60s or 70s. It's
always something, sorry to interrupt you, Jan, but it's always something to bear in mind, isn't it? When we're sitting in the City Hall or any concert hall, listening to a Steinway concert grand playing Chopin or even Beethoven, that is not the sound they heard.
Not at all. I mean, that doesn't mean that we shouldn't play Chopin on a modern piano, but just knowing that it sounded different and just being conscious of the fact that things were not exactly as we think they were. We tend to sort of sometimes live in an idealized past. I think it can make the music more alive for today as well. Mm-hmm. I recently read an account from the Gazette de Musique in Paris, which was the local musical newspaper. And it was funny, actually, because they spoke about Thalberg's playing, Chopin, Liszt, and César Franck's playing. So Thalberg, they said, he has wonderful fingers, but he doesn't make us dream at all. It's cold. Liszt is much more poetic with his rumbling chords and octaves and things. And Chopin's playing is most often too sentimental. And Franck, they said, Franck plays, he has a very percussive way of playing, which is not nice to listen to. Mm-hmm. But Chopin is a very delicate subject because I think his playing was very, very delicate, and he played so softly that people couldn't hear him actually in the hall. Obviously being sick as well and not being healthy.
Yes.
So I think one must really know what the instrument sounded like at the time of Chopin. And there are recordings of a student of a student of Chopin. So we can really imagine what it sounded like. And there are a lot of technical things that were done at the time of Chopin. For example, the hands were not always together, systematically not together, actually. And Chopin taught what they called the independence of the hands, so that the right hand was totally free from the left hand. And Berlioz actually found that Chopin's playing, the rhythm was changed so much that we couldn't make out anymore what the melody was.
My goodness.
So there's this extreme rubato, actually.
Yeah.
And it's nice to sort of, in my playing, I try sometimes an experiment and see, you know, how far can I take it? You know, it's speculation. I mean, we don't know.
We don't know for sure.
But having listened to a lot of these old recordings, I can sort of imagine it. And I think imagination is wonderful because you can sometimes go further with imagination than just real knowledge. We don't have the real knowledge. So,
remember just now I said to you that I thought Liszt was very much a showman, that everything was loud and you needed this fantastic technique. And sometimes, and a lot of my friends get rather cross with me, I have a similar block, in a sense, with Chopin here, I'm confessing. I'll probably get letters saying, I'll never listen to you again. Because, again, I'm always so often aware of the technique in the way of the music. I wonder, and it's improving with me, I'm getting better now. I've learned, for example, to appreciate the waltzes, really little gems that they are.
Yes, yes.
The first ballade, the G minor ballade, which actually was my great door into Chopin. But is it the players who are bringing the technique to the fore and forgetting about the poetic lyrical side?
Yes, my personal opinion is that Chopin's music is very delicate, and you know, some music can withstand bashing and too aggressive playing. Chopin does not really.
Definitely not. Even the etudes.
Yes, yes.
Or with those crashing scales and chords.
Yes.
But that style, apparently each etude is meant to demonstrate a different style of technique or something.
Yes,
so
yes.
That must have fascinated you as well, the technique that Chopin was using before Liszt.
Yes. Yes, yes. Well, the etudes are really interesting from this point of view. Like, most of the composers, when they were young, wrote etudes. And it's interesting because it was, the etudes were exercises, actually.
Yes.
And so you can see, like, it's sort of a showcase of what the pianist composer can do. And Chopin was known to be able to thread arpeggios very softly and very he wanted suppleness in playing. And so so the first etude, opus 10 number 1, actually should be extremely supple and extremely soft and on a playal of Chopin's time,
but yet it's played in a thundering way, isn't it?
Those
cascading scales.
Well, I mean, we can do it. It can, it can work. But I think it's, we must always bring out the more lyrical side, the most, I wouldn't say sentimental side, but the emotional side of this music. It's always dripping with emotion. And that's what made Chopin so special, actually. If you read what George Sand said about Chopin, she said he could take a small piece like the waltzes or a little mazurka and make a whole poem out of it.
Absolutely.
And I think that's, one must bear that in mind when playing Chopin. It's
play it softly.
Not necessarily. I mean, Chopin played very softly, but that was also because he was sick. And, you know, his students said, you know, we shouldn't, even though Chopin played softly, we can give it a bit more robust sound. But keeping that, just that idea of what Chopin really is.
Yes.
And my wife being a singer, I'm very interested as well in the art of bel canto. And there are obviously a lot of recordings of singing as well of the end of the 19th century.
Yes, indeed.
And there are a few recordings of the real bel canto singers, but Adelina Patti and Ferdinando de Lucia. And we know that Chopin loved bel canto singing. And so if you have this bel canto sound in your head, and then you look at Chopin's nocturnes, for example, it's pure bel canto. And all the ornaments and everything. And so you must really, you know, it must be really be sung on the piano. And I must say, historical instrument does help because the registers are more differentiated and the middle register is very warm and very, the tone is very cantabile. So
you're giving me homework to do, Jan. Now, what's your next piece of music?
So my next piece of music is a Chopin nocturne played by a student of Chopin. So Raoul von Kochalski. He was a child prodigy. I think he was born in the 1850s, if I'm not wrong. And he studied with Mikuli. Mikuli made a Chopin edition. And some of these older editions are actually edited by Mikuli, and all the fingering and things are said to come from Chopin. Mikuli was so passionate about Chopin's playing and his music that he did not want to listen to any other composer for fear of losing love for Chopin.
Okay. So,
and this recording is actually, it was the 100-year anniversary of Chopin's death, and it's played on Chopin's piano. So it's a wonderful historical document of a pianist from the direct Chopin tradition, playing on Chopin's piano.
I can't wait to listen. Let's listen. Well, we're having a fascinating time here listening to pianists who lived a very long time ago. And we've just heard the Nocturne in D flat, Opus 27, number 2 by Chopin, played by Raoul von Kaczalski, who was a pupil of Chopin. Is that right, Jan?
That is right, yes.
Jan Hugo is giving us a lesson here on 19th century piano playing. Jan Hugo, the concert pianist living in France at the moment and who is just finishing a tour in South Africa. And by the time you hear this interview, he'll be back home in France. Jan, I want to go back to other names you've mentioned in your studies of 19th century style of playing are Clara Schumann. Well, that's the other one. Because, again, I think we underestimate what a huge figure she was as a concert pianist.
Yes.
We think of her as Schumann's wife who could play the piano. But, I mean, she was a startlingly efficient and excellent concert pianist, wasn't she?
Yes.
And composer.
Yes, yes. Actually, in Leipzig, I played some of her pieces with oboe and we lived quite close to the Schumann's first home, so they were sort of our neighbors.
Very true.
Yes, Clara Schumann is an interesting character, actually. There are, again, quite a few recordings of her students, and it's wonderful piano playing, really. It's fantastic and very different from the Liszt students. Like, what's interesting about these things is the individuality of each artist was extremely strong.
Mm-hmm.
They also really encouraged their students to be individual, and you know, they would, many of the teachers in the 19th century would get really angry if the students imitated what the teacher did. Chopin especially, actually. So Clara Schumann, I think, you know, she really grew up the musical world also evolved enormously during her time, and I think if it wasn't for Clara Schumann, Schumann's music would not be what it is. I mean, we would not know it that well. She did redid all the editions and everything, and I think she really did a lot for Robert Schumann. So it's a very interesting character.
And he must have written a lot of his piano pieces, especially with her in mind.
Yes.
Those suites and things.
Yes.
Kinderzähne and Papillon for Clara to play. And when you hear her own music, you also hear that tremendous sort of early romantic lyricism that you hear in Robert Schumann's piano music.
Yes, exactly, yes. And some of her pieces are actually quite dark, actually. Mm-hmm. I think it's the Fantasiestücke for violin or oboe and piano, and it's very depressing, nearly, this music. And you wonder how the relationship between Clara Schumann and Robert actually developed, and you know, it's like with Mahler and Alma Mahler. You know, you don't know how much in Schumann's music is from Clara and how this mixture actually is.
Because they were both fairly neurotic men, weren't they?
Yes.
And yet were passionately in love with their women,
who
were much more worldly and outgoing,
yes,
like Alma Mahler was.
Yes,
and
yes.
I'm sure there was elements of jealousy and insecurities and all between the two of them.
And especially, I mean, for a woman at that time, to be a concert pianist like Clara Schumann was not something easy.
No.
To travel alone.
And also, I mean, around about the same time, Fanny Mendelssohn was sort of kept out of the spotlight.
Yes.
Mostly by her brother.
By
Felix,
her brother,
kept out of the spotlight, both as a composer and as a player. So it wasn't a good time for women.
Yes, yes. I think Clara Schumann was also, she was very hard on her children. But if you see it in the context in which she lived and, you know, having to travel and earn money for all her children and being a woman traveling alone, I think it was hard.
A tricky time. I saw somewhere, Jan, that for one of the Liszt competitions, you played on a new straight-strung concert grand made by Chris Mayne?
Mahner, yes.
Mahner. What is that?
So you might have heard that a few years ago, Barenboim had a new piano made with straight strings. Actually, Chris Mahner made this piano. So at the Liszt competition in Utrecht, they had two of these straight-strung pianos. And we had 35 minutes to choose out of 8 different pianos, and I immediately felt a connection with the Chris Mahner piano. Because having played on historical instruments and Erhard pianos, and you immediately feel something in this instrument, especially because the registers are very clear, it's very defined. And I really just felt at home on this piano, and I think it's wonderful that things are moving in the piano world, because basically, the modern Steinway is more or less where the evolution of the piano stopped in the early 20th century. Nothing has changed much. And I think it's good to... What I love what Chris Mahner is doing is this inspiration from the past to make something modern and something new.
With modern technology. Exactly.
Yes.
Jan, I just want to ask you, I hope I'm not going to make a fool of myself now, a straight-strung concert grand, aren't all concert grands straight-strung?
No, okay, so actually...
so it's not such a stupid
On a question. Modern piano, the bass strings are crossed over the middle register strings.
Oh, yes.
In pianos up until, I don't want to say wrong dates, but let's say up until the 1860s or 70s, the bass strings were straight. What they did at one stage is to get more power out of the instruments, they crossed over the bass strings, but only in the concert grands. And this has actually become standard for all pianos, and it creates a bit of a problem with the middle register. The voicing isn't very clear anymore, and you get some sort of, especially with pedal, using the pedal, you have to be very, very careful with the pedal on modern piano. And with a piano where the bass strings are straight, there's more clarity. So that makes it very interesting to play, I mean, Beethoven and Schubert, etc., but also romantic music, because the pedaling and the, especially in Chopin and Liszt, a lot of the original pedal indications were written for instruments with straight strung and parallel strings. Yeah, it's wonderful to be able to do that on a modern piano with the big sound for a big hall.
Of course.
Yes.
But then, as you say, to have the straight strung is a special feeling for you.
Yes.
To sit there, and as you also made the point a couple of times, that the registers are much more defined.
Yes.
Through the
piece. It really sounds like an orchestra. You can orchestrate much better on this instrument. So, I mean, the views, you know, opinions on this instrument are divided.
Yeah. I know Daniel Barenboim, the piano he made a recording relatively recently. I can't remember what he recorded, but I know it was quite well received by, for example, Gramophone magazine, with one or two little, you know what critics
are
like.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, something new will always divide opinion.
Yes.
But I personally appreciate the instrument a lot, and I will be giving a recital on it at the beginning of June.
So. Oh dear, we'll have to come over. Jan, let's have another piece of music, and I hear you're going to introduce The Voice, which has played an important part in your life.
Yes.
And you married a voice apart from anything else.
Yes. So the next piece is actually the Elegy by Massenet, sung by the Russian bass Shalyapin.
Good grief.
Shalyapin is a wonderful character. I mean, he was a homeless person, and he got into singing later in his life. It's a bit over the top, but it shows what people did with music at the time and how much emotion and personal expression was such a big part of music making. I really love his voice. And what's interesting is that Shalyapin actually had a bel canto training, which one doesn't always think of.
But actually
his voice is clear, and the vowel, he sings in Russian, but he doesn't round his voice too much. It's very clear, and the breath is always conducted. I don't know if you say that in English, but but it's always in the phrase, and I really love his singing. So it's something. It probably sounds a bit kitsch today, but I think it's important to hear what music making was at the time.
The world is
Famous Russian bass, Shalyapin, singing that elegy by Massenet. We've been given an excellent history lesson by you, young Hugo, with your pianos, with the people we've heard, Chopin's piano itself. And as I said to you, I thought when I saw a note about research into 19th century playing that it might have just been a paper you're working on. But clearly, as you said earlier, it's very much your life.
Yes, yes, yes. When I discovered this, it just totally changed everything. And my wife and I just, we spend our days just talking about this and listening and working together. And
oh, it must be really wonderful. And what a wonderful thing to be involved in. But you still, for example, would come to Cape Town and play a romantic piano concerto.
Oh, yes, if yes, you were completely. Asked to. Yes, yes. I'm not against modern instruments or anything. What I just want is to just share this passion on whatever instrument I can find, actually.
Well, we've got a nice brand new Steinway here at Cape Town City Hall when it's fixed again. So I know the last time you were here, I think you played Chopin, one of the Chopin concertos.
Oh, no, I played the Mendelssohn concerto
last time.
Oh, was
it Mendelssohn?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Now, look, we're going to have to stop.
Okay.
But I just want to say thank you for a really fascinating discussion
that
I didn't really expect in such detail.
Oh.
And a wonderful link with students of Liszt and Chopin and Clara Schumann.
Mm.
And so you haven't played any orchestral music yet, and I gather there's some orchestral music to see you out of the studio.
Yes, it will be the beginning of Le Sacre du Printemps by Stravinsky, conducted by Pierre Monteux, who did the premiere.
And where there was the riot, the famous
yes,
riot.
Yes, the famous riot in Paris.
Why have you chosen this, Jan?
I've chosen this because I think it's interesting to hear what Stravinsky sounded like at the time that he was alive and at the premiere. And it's a very French way of making music. The lines are all very clear. It's less, I would say, it's less aggressive than maybe the modern way of doing Le Sacre du Printemps. But what's interesting is this rhythmic element is extremely clear. The rhythms are, I can understand why there was a riot actually at the first. So it'll just be the beginning, but I think it's really interesting just to hear the sounds of this piece.
And also, it is a ballet. It's
yes.
maybe not meant to be that violent.
Yes,
and I think, if I remember correctly, if you listen to Stravinsky's own recording, the stereo recording, it's not quite as bombastic
exactly,
as some of the
exactly.
modern recordings.
Yes, yes.
So let's listen now to Pierre Monteur, who conducted the premiere of Le Sacre, doing, well, it's a slightly later recording, but anyway, the opening of the Rite of Spring. And Jan Hugo, it's been fascinating talking to you. Thanks for spending time. Bon voyage back to France.
Thank you very much.
And come and visit us again.
I will definitely.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
This December, something extraordinary is coming to Cape Town. Experience the global phenomenon Matilda the Musical, inspired by the magic of Roald Dahl, live on stage at Artscape. The New York Post says, believe the hype. Don't miss the musical of the decade. Proudly brought to you by Peter Turin and GWB Entertainment in association with the Royal Shakespeare Company. Be a genius. Book now. FMR.